Gold statues, mysterious glass structures, or hometown businesses. Which listener-submitted topic do you want WFAE to report on during the next FAQ City podcast? Cast your vote and contribute your own question right now on WFAE.org/FAQ City.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Kirsten Garris with Spectrum News, in today for Mike Collins.
Si se puede! Si se puede!
Last February, upwards of 8,000 immigrants and others marched in Uptown in response to the immigration policies and rhetoric of the barely month-old Trump administration. It was part of a national Day Without Immigrants. The show of force coincided with President Donald Trump's directive to arrest and deport illegal immigrants, even if they had no criminal background. The immigration rhetoric out of Washington resonates with the growing Hispanic population in the Charlotte area and across the Southeast. Not only are Hispanics one of the fastest growing minority groups, they're also growing as a voting bloc. The number of eligible Hispanic voters rose by 4 million between 2012 and 2016. Despite this growth, we still haven't seen the Latino surge in voter turnout in recent presidential elections. This hour on Charlotte Talks, we look at the Hispanic vote and the role they could play in the 2018 elections. First, let's look at some numbers from the Hispanic voting bloc here and nationally. Jens Manuel Cogstad studies Latino political engagement for the Pew Research Center. Thanks for joining us, gents. I want to just jump right into some data. How long has the Pew Research Center been following Hispanic voters, and what trends have you noticed over the past few presidential elections?
Well, the Pew Hispanic Center has been around for about 15 years, and we've been tracking the Latino vote going back even further than that because census data goes back a few decades. And so since the mid-80s, since 86, 84, we have data on the Latino vote, and overall the trends nationally are going downward. So the Latino voter turnout rate has either been relatively stable or gone down a little bit.
Zeroing in on North Carolina, I know we have a pretty high Hispanic rate, you know, moving into the state. What have you noticed in terms of trends in the Tar Heel state?
So North Carolina is one of the states that we track each election year, each election cycle, because it has a growing number of Latinos, and now it has one of the larger Latino populations in the country. And so in 2016, there were about 250,000 eligible voters who were Latino, and that was number 17 in the country. And that number has been trending upward because in recent years, a lot of the growth in the Latino population in the United States has been occurring in the Carolinas and in the Southeast states like Tennessee and Georgia.
Looking at African Americans and Asian Americans, when you compare voter turnout between those minority groups, how do Hispanic voters kind of stack up?
Generally, the Hispanic voter turnout rate and the Asian voter turnout rate have been fairly similar, and they've trailed by significant margins the voter turnout rate of whites and blacks. And so, for example, well, I guess we can start with the presidential election. Voter turnout rates were about 50% for Hispanics, and it was about 65% for whites and blacks. And Asians were also around 50%. And for midterm elections, voter turnout overall is lower, and that's the case for Hispanics as well. So in 2014, the Latino voter turnout rate nationally fell to a record low. It was down to about 1 in 4 Hispanic eligible voters voted in 2014.
I've looked at some of your research, and what I thought was interesting is just the number of millennials that make up Hispanic voters. I know one of your reports shows that 44% of eligible Hispanic voters were millennials. What, I guess, could be driving that percentage?
The Latino population is significantly younger than the U.S. general population. So to illustrate that, the median age for Hispanics, for U.S.-born Hispanics, is 19 years old. And by comparison, the median age for foreign-born Hispanics is 42, and for whites, overall, it's 43 years old. So Hispanics are a very young group and very young demographic. And so that's why you see millennials making up such a large share of eligible voters. And to put them in comparison to other groups, 44% of Hispanic eligible voters are millennials. For whites, that's 27%.
But now I know I've noticed in past elections, millennials may be registered to vote, but whether they turn out to actually vote is another question. What do we see with Hispanic voters who are millennials? Did they actually go out to the polls in November?
That's a great question, because that it could be one of the reasons why the Hispanic voter turnout rate has remained low over the recent years and decades. It might just be simply that Hispanics are young, and young people in general, regardless of race and ethnicity, have lower voter turnout rates. So to give you a sense for that, in 2012, the millennial voter turnout rate for Hispanics was 38%. And for older Hispanics, it was well above 50%. So, for example, for boomers who are Hispanic, it was 57%.
And another takeaway that I thought was striking from some of their 2016 data was that Hispanic voters weren't necessarily voting for something. They were voting against something. I know one of your studies, you showed that Hillary Clinton had support from millennial voters who were Hispanic, but it wasn't because they were supporting her. It was because they were voting against Donald Trump. Is that the kind of mindset we might see moving ahead to the 2018 midterm elections, that people are voting against an ideal versus for one?
Yeah, that's something we're going to be exploring in our surveys coming up. Certainly, Latinos were paying attention to President Donald Trump during the 2016 elections. And so if he's again front and center in campaigns in 2018, that might happen again.
Traditionally, we've seen Hispanic voters have been, I guess, favor the Democratic Party, but obviously some of them are registered as Republicans. But what about those who identify as unaffiliated? Just to give you some context, right now in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, there are more than 11,000 Hispanic voters who are registered as unaffiliated. That's about the same number as the total Hispanic voters we had for the entire county 8 years ago. So this increase in unaffiliated voters, could this be mirroring the national dissatisfaction with the two major parties?
Yeah, it's possible. Hispanics overall have identified more with the Democratic Party than the Republican Party nationally, and they'll tell us also that they think the Democratic Party cares more about Latinos than Republicans. But there's been some increase in the share of Latinos who say that they don't see that big of a difference between the parties. And that shift we saw happen before the 2016 election. And so it'll be interesting to see if that trend is continuing or if it's going to change heading into the 2018 elections.
And another thing that I know a lot of folks are probably tracking is just what issues might be driving people to the polls. I know immigration was a big talker in 2016. It's still a big discussion right now in 2018 with talk of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival. Do you think immigration will drive folks to the polls this year, or Hispanic voters to the polls this year?
Yeah, immigration is an interesting issue because it's associated with Hispanics a lot. But when we ask Hispanics what issues they care about most, they've consistently for years now cited education and the economy and even healthcare as issues that are bigger priorities for them than immigration. So whether or not immigration is something that drives them to the polls is something that remains to be seen.
We were just talking about that we have a big election, at least the primaries, in May here in Mecklenburg County. Looking ahead to the 2018 midterms, what projections do you see in terms of Hispanic voters going to the polls? Do you guys know how many thousands or millions we could expect?
So for the midterms, the thing we're going to be keeping a track of is just the overall turnout in the U.S. Because oftentimes, the Hispanic turnout mirrors the overall turnout. So in 2014, the Latino voter turnout rate fell to a record low, and it was also a year when voter turnout overall fell. And to give you a sense of the overall numbers, about 6.8 million Hispanics voted in 2014 in congressional elections. And that was a record number, and it achieved that record number despite the low voter turnout rate, just because of the population growth of the Hispanic of Hispanics in the U.S. So just by virtue of demographic growth, Hispanic vote totals increase each election cycle. So you might hear something about a record number of Hispanics voting, even if their voter turnout rates maybe even declined over the previous cycle.
Have you noticed any of the parties, like Democrats or Republicans, kind of making an effort to really mobilize Hispanic voters? I know I was struck by last year with how Democrats and even African Americans really rallied around Doug Jones in Alabama. Could we see that same push from the parties trying to rally minority voters in the 2018 midterms?
Yeah, I know there were a lot of efforts to register new Latino voters in the run-up to the 2016 election, to turn Latinos out to the polls in the 2016 election. And from everything I've seen, it sounds like those efforts are going to continue into the 2018 election. So the question remains to see is how successful those efforts are going to be, because in 2016 we saw voter turnout rates hold relatively steady despite lots of mobilization efforts nationwide.
This is the only time I get really, I like numbers when it comes to election time. So thank you for bearing with my inner nerd today. But thinking ahead, I know it's still a little kind of early, but even 2020, obviously, you know, we've heard President Trump kind of hint that he is going to be running again. You know, do we have projections of just the kind of growth we could see with Hispanic voters between now and then?
We haven't done projections into 2020, but the Latino population is continuing to grow. There were about 27 million eligible voters in 2016, and so that number is projected to continue to grow. Especially because U.S.-born Hispanics are driving a lot of the growth, and so U.S.-born Hispanics, once they turn 18, are eligible to vote. So definitely see more than 27 million Hispanics eligible to vote in 2020. The other thing to keep track of with eligible voters is naturalization rates and growth. Growth in the immigrant population, and also people coming from Puerto Rico. That's another thing that we're going to be keeping track of, although that's more of a regional impact, especially in Florida.
And do you have any trends for North Carolina? I know just as a battleground state, a lot of folks pay attention to the Tar Heel State. And as you mentioned earlier in the program, that we do have one of the highest growing Hispanic rates in the country. You know, do you notice... Do you think North Carolina could be growing? Could those numbers grow in North Carolina with naturalization and just people coming here? Could North Carolina have more Hispanic voters by 2020?
Yeah, definitely. And before the 2016 election, there were about 164,000 Latinos registered to vote statewide in North Carolina. So I would expect that number to grow before the 2018 elections. And certainly before the 2020 elections, I'm not sure how midterm numbers would stack up. But that's just by virtue of demographic growth, and we're seeing that the Latino population is continuing to grow in North Carolina.
That's Jens Manuel Cogstad with the Pew Research Center. When we come back, we look at how the Latino vote is being mobilized locally. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Well, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Kirsten Garris in for Mike Collins, and our discussion about Hispanic voters and their role in this year's election continues with some local experts and community activists. Joining me now in the studio, we have Maggie Cummins from Queens University of Charlotte. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Greg Weeks from UNC Charlotte. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Alma Echeverry, who is with the Civic Engagement Committee of the Latin American Leadership Future Search.
Thank you.
Got your title right.
Yes.
And then Jose Hernandez-Perez, who is the Executive Director of the Latin American Coalition. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So I'll start with our professors. Let's talk about just who are Hispanic voters in Mecklenburg County? Do we know the breakdown of some of the baby boomers, millennials? Do we kind of know what's a picture of Hispanic voters here?
Well, the Hispanic voters in North Carolina and in Mecklenburg County are young. So you have a lot of people who are native-born citizens, and they're just now in the last couple of years have been coming of age. So unlike the rest of the country, it's going to be a much younger voter, which is then going to have sort of different impact on voting patterns.
And with millennial voters, nationally, millennials are registered to vote, but they don't always show up. Do we know how Hispanic millennial voters vote here? Do they show up to the polls?
The short answer is no. So that really you can see that as people age, they vote more. So if you look at people who are 60 and older, they're going to be the ones who are voting in the largest numbers. So the real challenge that Latino voters have is that millennials are the least likely to vote, and Latinos of all racial and ethnic groups are the least likely to vote. So it's sort of a double whammy.
Gotcha. And I know right now immigration has been a huge national discussion with things like DACA, the status of these Dreamers. What are some of the issues that could be driving this election?
Well, we found that with the 2016 election as well, and we can assume similar dynamics for this election, that even Latino voters tend to be animated more by economic concerns than by immigration concerns, that immigration is not noted consistently as a strong issue for voters, and that, in fact, it has an effect of mobilizing Republican voters more than Democratic voters. So Republican sort of anti-immigrant voting seems to be more animated in an election, more motivated to turn out than Democratic voters.
And Jose and Alma, I want to get you guys in the conversation. What are some of the issues you're hearing, on the ground? What are folks really focused on this year?
Specifically this year, it's obvious that it's the sheriff's race because it is tied to the larger debate on immigration, but on a local level. And that has energized the community. We are hoping that that race will make a difference in our numbers voting this year.
Gotcha. So I know for those who don't know, the sheriff's race has been heavily focused around 287G, which is a federal voluntary program that allows the sheriff to flag jail inmates for potential deportation proceedings. Do you think, how are you guys, I know you guys have been very active with forums. I guess talk to me about what you guys have been doing in the Hispanic community to get people engaged and informed about these issues.
We just finished the forums this week. We are engaging in social media. Latinos or Hispanics are the highest users of social media, including Facebook and Instagram and that type of thing. So we have a campaign going on social media encouraging people to vote and put your picture with your frame that says "Tu voto cuenta," and also to video yourself when you go and vote and encourage others to vote. That is on a personal level, but also all the organizations that work with Latinos have come together to make sure that this campaign is amplified with their members. And, of course, the Latin American Coalition is one, the Latin American Chamber of Commerce, and many others. I don't remember them all, and I don't want to leave anybody out. But it was unprecedented that we were able to get everybody under the same roof to work to get out the vote this year. So I think I'm hoping that the numbers are going to improve dramatically.
Yeah. And Jose, do you have anything to add to that? Because I know I saw you at a couple of those forums. I know you guys hosted one for the sheriff's candidates. I know North Carolina representatives, House and Senate, and even for County Commission. And you also hosted them at Manolo's Bakery, which for those who aren't familiar with East Charlotte is definitely a staple of that community. And it's a very small, quaint place. What were your thoughts on having these political forums in a place that's, that's well known in the community?
Yeah, I think it's important that for many years, people running for office have asked the community to reach out to them. And so I think now the community is starting to respond and it's reaching back. And a way of reaching back is to invite them to where we live and to places that we frequent. So it speaks loudly when those candidates come and participate. And when they don't participate, that speaks loudly because I think at times there's a fear in associated with participating in certain forums in certain places, and I think it's something that we need to get comfortable with. And if you're going to represent the community, you need to be able to be part of that community and be present. So I think it's exciting this year. Like Omar was saying, it's unprecedented that I think. We are getting together and promoting the vote. There are individuals and organizations who are partisan and they will promote the vote one way or another. But for us, the main interest is to ingrain in our culture that love for voting and transfer that to our youth.
Mm-hmm. And I know how successful do you think they were on the flip side? You mentioned obviously it's good for candidates to come to the community. What was the community reaction to having folks come in and share their platform in their neighborhood?
Yeah, honestly, I think it was timid. I think participation could have been greater, but that's part of this process, right? As we see that candidates are reaching out, as we hear, and as Omar was saying, you know, we do, even though we are not there present, we do communicate and we do share. And even though some individuals were not there participating, someone else is saying, do you know who was present? Or do you know who was not present? So the impact is larger than just individual participation on that day. I think it could be better. And we're working in internally to increase that. But I think it's part of the acculturation. It's a process.
And speaking of getting better with those numbers, I want to bring up some numbers from the last couple of elections. So 2010, I know there were almost about 11,628 Hispanic voters registered in Mecklenburg County, 200 voted in that election. Mm-hmm. 2014, nearly 20,000 Hispanic voters registered in Mecklenburg County, only 414 voted. Now we have nearly 30,000 Hispanic voters registered in Mecklenburg County. What do you guys plan to do to mobilize that vote?
What we said that we are doing, which is the social media, is number one, and trying to have impact when you go vote and make sure that somebody goes with you, making sure that any of the people involved in the forums and in the organizations are ready to ask questions as to where to go vote. I do have to say that the Hispanic media has been excellent. They have provided radio time, and they have provided coverage for not only the forums, but many other events and information on particular candidates. So the information is out there. I believe that we are reaching thousands of people, and we are, of course, hoping that our numbers will be in the thousands. And 2010 is not a good year to compare to anybody because the numbers were lower for any community in 2010. So we're all together trying to make sure that people go out and vote and that they vote early also.
Professor Weeks?
I was thinking along these lines. I was looking at U.S. Census data, and they have respondents say, if you didn't vote, what were the reasons you didn't vote? And Latinos had the highest rates for not voting. This is from the 2016 election, either because they weren't interested, because it was too busy, conflicting schedules, or registration problems. So it's absolutely essential, these sorts of efforts, because there are all these barriers, which might just be I have to work, or I don't have a car, or I don't know exactly where to go. And the more that you have volunteers who are helping them do that, that's really the only way to make a major difference.
Yes, thank you for saying that, because people are intimidated by the actual process and not knowing the law, for example, that you are allowed to bring somebody with you to help you. It's huge. Not being familiar with the locations, it's also a block. So having information out there from our Hispanic media is crucial. on trying to increase the numbers. And of course, you know, what we do individually as grassroots leaders, and there are many others that are doing that job as we speak. So I'm holding my breath. I'm being very optimistic.
And to add to what Oma's saying, we have seen that with a lot of our grassroots efforts, is that we have a large constituency who work in per hour and in the service industry, where a lot of the employers don't give, even if they have a right, don't give that right for people to go and excuse themselves and vote. And when you have to leave, that affects your bottom line, your pocket. You can't earn that money. Then it's an impediment in our community. So I know there are barriers, and we call them second walls, that are put sometimes out there in the community that doesn't help, but makes voting a privilege versus a right. That's the part where we're stepping on. When we realize that this is happening, then it's a community we're trying to address that. And part of that is the education and the acculturating our own community in understanding their right in the process.
And do you think just language materials are a barrier? Because I noticed that a lot of election just information isn't really in Spanish. Do you think that has to change? Do you think there needs to be more information just in Spanish so people can understand how to vote?
I think it does help, but I don't think it's the biggest barrier. I think when there's interest, there's information that's out there, you know. I just think more of it, I think, is just some more external. I don't think language is the main impediment.
Yeah. There are many candidates that are sensitive enough to have their information in Spanish, and that's very much appreciated. But, yeah, the information is out there, and we're trying to promote, you know, where to vote, the times, et cetera. And hopefully that will help. But we're also offering ourselves personally for people that have challenges with transportation or language, actually, to help you at the voting booth.
And speaking kind of the other end of this, obviously you guys are trying to mobilize a vote, but voter turnout is something that is traditionally low during non-presidential years. I know in 2010 it was 7% here locally, 2014 almost 10%, 9.6. For my professors, what could we maybe expect this year when you do have more community engagement? I know we have seen more candidates putting things in Spanish, but again, I know 2016's presidential election, a lot of people were motivated last year to get out and vote. And I know in Charlotte we had a higher turnout rate in the 2017 election. Do you think that same energy from the last presidential election will filter into this one locally? Do you think we could see a higher turnout rate?
Are you talking about the primary?
Yes, for the primary.
So turnout's even lower in primary. It's lower in non-presidential years, and it's lower in primary. So it was less than 10% in 2014. And I was looking at the map of that, and it's the same map that you would expect for income in Charlotte. So turnout is higher in higher income areas, and that pie slice in South Charlotte and in the Lake area. So some of those same dynamics are at work. So it will really be an interesting test case to see if the hard work and the organization that Oma and Jose and others have put together will really bear fruit this time. But if the past is any indication, it will be quite low.
And I know that is for all voters, not just one specific race. But moving on, kind of back to a topic, I know I don't want to make this about 287G, but that has been a big talker, at least locally, with the sheriff's race. And it even has filtered a little bit into the district attorney's race, because obviously that's a judicial position. Do you guys think, I'll start with our professors, could this make or break Sheriff Carmichael? Because this policy was in place in 2014 when he was elected, but this year it's become a very big talker. What do you think, what kind of impact could this have on his chances of being reelected?
If I had to predict, I would say that it would be relatively low, just because it's just so difficult to get the number of voters that you need who are going to be voting on that issue, because you're already facing, as Maggie was pointing out, the issue that many people who will be voting or might be mobilized are older and white, and they might not actually be opposed to it. So I think in thinking about whether it'd be make or break, my gut feeling is probably not.
And let me ask this program, again, has been around since 2006. the couple of sheriffs have been kind of in position of power during this program. Why now? Why is this becoming an issue now that people are talking about, vocalizing their concerns about?
Well, I think from our side, we have seen after this time that it's an organization that we have seen 287G in action in a few of the counties around the country. We have seen the statistics on the impact that that has. And the statistics are very clear. And so when they're trying to sell 287G is because it makes us safer as a community. But the statistics have shown absolutely the reverse. And just in Charlotte, we had a woman recently, a Latino woman who was shot and killed going to work. And when they interviewed, the media interviewed folks and they talked about this issue, that came out again, that people are afraid to come to the police and denounce. And it wasn't the first time she was robbed. It has happened multiple times. And part of the question to the family is, why haven't you spoken up? And the answer is, well, we're afraid of law enforcement right now. So CMPD is trying to do a great job in reaching out to the community, hiring bilingual officers and all of that. And we have some issues with justice, access to justice and equitable justice, right? That's there, right? But at least you're trying, right, to have people that understand the culture and that can reach the culture. But on the other side, you have a sheriff's office that has a policy that is a detriment to the safety of that community, not only Latinos, but all of us. So at this point, I think most people understand that the policy is being sold as making us safer. But if people really look at the reality of the statistics, it's not making us safer. It's actually more expensive for our county, and it's actually making us less safe.
And I will actually, on that point, we'll hold off for a second because we obviously have a lot more to talk about. When we come back, we will continue discussing 287G, how that might play a factor in this year's election, and what will happen come May 8th. Stay with us. We're back with Charlotte Talks. I'm Kirsten Garris in for Mike Collins. Today, we are talking about Hispanic voters and their role in this year's election. Joining me in the studio is Jose Hernandez-Paris, who is the executive director for the Latin American Coalition. Greg Weeks is a professor from UNC Charlotte. Maggie Cummins, is a professor from Queens University of Charlotte. And Alma Echeverry is with the Civic Engagement Committee of the Latin American Leadership Future Search. And we were just discussing 287G and how it may play a role in this year's sheriff's election. I know, Alma, you were starting to say a comment. Feel free to continue.
Thank you. Your question started by why now? Right now, the impact is so big that we are not talking about two or three or even 10 individuals. We are talking about thousands. So when you are detained and you are the breadwinner for that family and you're turned over to immigration, then that impacts the whole community. Is not only that family, is those that are the dependents of that person. And also the other misconception is that, yes, there are criminals that are apprehended, and nobody wants criminals in the midst of their communities. However, the majority of the people that are apprehended through traffic violations. And I have yet to see a person that is not a person of color that is detained because your stoplight is not working or because your license plate doesn't have the sticker that it needs to be renewed. So we need to be very clear that, like Jose says, is being portrayed as a community saver when it really isn't. And that is why now. And it's been time for us to speak up, and we've been speaking up for a number of years, but this needs to stop.
And Maggie, I want to bring you in. I know you have actually studied and looked at 287G. What have you noticed over the years? I mean, I guess, the conversation peaked lately, or is it just something that people have been talking about, but we're just now, I guess, hearing these voices?
No, the conversation has definitely peaked lately, particularly here in Charlotte. 287G is actually part of a 1996 federal law. It's named after provision of that law, and it was essentially not used until after 9/11. So it's very much associated with immigration enforcement. And even during the Obama administration, there were less than 40 jurisdictions that had 287G. I was just checking this morning, and they're now over 70. There were 68 2 weeks ago when we had the sheriffs on campus talking about it, and there's 65 or so now. So that's increasing significantly under the Trump administration. So in an overall context of immigration enforcement, it's still a very, very small proportion. I mean, there are 1,500 or more local law enforcement agencies in the United States, and only 70 of them have 287G. So it's still a very small minority, but the overall immigration context has changed. And one of the most important ways in which it's changed is that ICE now essentially has no priorities for deportation. Everybody is a priority for deportation. So whereas under the Obama administration, they moved toward, you know, severe crimes and things being the reasons for deportation. Now, essentially, if you're in the country illegally and you come in contact with the justice system, you are going to be more than likely put into deportation proceedings. You certainly will if you come into, ICE will be notified if you come into our jail. And that's a major change. And the community is feeling it.
And what I wanted to add is that the problem is not necessarily documented or undocumented. The problem is who is targeted. Are they targeted because of how you look, or are you targeted because you have an accent, or are you targeted because you live in a certain area of Charlotte? So if you look at the demographics, if you look at the geography of where people are being detained, it's very obvious. And you look at the demographics, it's very obvious who's being detained and who's being targeted. So are we in Charlotte? I've been in Charlotte for 40 years. I grew up in Charlotte. Are we in Charlotte that kind of community? That we're going to support stereotypes, that we're going to target people and disvalue people based on how they look? Or are we in Charlotte a community that is welcoming, a community, the community that created the Bank of America Tower with an Argentinian architect and with Mexican and Central American labor? Are we that kind of community, or are we the community that are going to segment, stereotype, and discriminate?
There's a sort of a regional character to this. So of the 70-plus jurisdictions that have 287G, a third of them are in Texas alone. Georgia is the next with 7. North Carolina has 6. Nationally, there are two-thirds of them are in the South. You know, obviously, if you include Texas and the South. So the South is the area of the country with the newest surge in Latino immigration. And so there's a very real connection here. If you look at the major immigrant destinations, the New Yorks, the Californias, even the Floridas, there are a couple jurisdictions there, they don't have 287G in the main. It's mostly in the new immigrant destinations. And that's commensurate with other anti-immigrant or restrictive type of immigration policies that we've seen.
Why is that?
Well, you know, my colleague and I actually have done some research on this, and it seems to be the most important predictor of restrictive immigration policies is a rapid increase in foreign-born populations that are not on top of an existing foreign-born population. So where there are foreign-born populations that have been there for a long time, California, Florida, you don't tend to have the same dynamic. But when you have a population that hasn't had a lot of foreign-born residents, and then you have a huge increase, I mean, the population doubled, right, of Latinos in North Carolina between 2000 and 2012, then you sort of get these restrictive policies that come out of it. In the long run, that changes, but in the short run, that's very much what we have seen.
Well, let me ask this. I know earlier in the program, we did talk with someone from the Pew Research Center, and in one of their reports, it showed that Latino voters in 2016 weren't necessarily voting for a candidate, but more against one. And it was for a lot of millennial voters who are Hispanic were voting for Hillary Clinton, but not because they supported her necessarily as a candidate, but because they were voting against Donald Trump. Do you think we might see that in this election, that people might not necessarily be voting for a sheriff's candidate, but on the other end, voting against 287G? I'll start with you guys, and then we'll go to our professors.
That could be, but I'm fine with that. I'm perfectly fine with people voting around the issues. And if that's what it takes, amen. We as a community, the Latino or Hispanic community, have grown in the sense that we are very good about working on particular issues. We're there. what we need to do is step up a little bit and become not only an influencer, but have that power of a political community. And having an issue like this that could perhaps increase the number of voters for us, that's a great step because that will show us that we're getting there. And actually, we need to get there pretty quickly because we need to be part of that political power within our county, our state, and the nation.
From a political analyst side, is there any data? I mean, have you guys noticed that people are voting for something versus are voting against something versus for? I mean, I know that was kind of a mindset nationally. Do you think that's something that could set in here for November?
I tend to think yes. And you see the increase of unaffiliated voters, which is suggesting disenchantment with both parties. I think one danger that you could potentially have with Latino voters in particular is that if they don't feel tied to a party, then it's much harder to mobilize voters. It's much harder to get them excited. It's much harder to get them to run for office. And that's critical. That's why in places that didn't have foreign-born populations, all the elected officials are native-born and most likely white. So I think a serious challenge for the Democratic Party, well, and the Republican Party, honestly, is to say, why should you vote for my party? And people are doing that less and less.
And actually, you brought up unaffiliated voters, and what's interesting, the number of Hispanic unaffiliated voters is almost 12,000 right now. That's almost the same number of total Hispanic voters from 8 years ago. So, I mean, that group has grown so much. How powerful is the unaffiliated voter? How powerful is that group since we don't know where their allegiance is, so to speak?
Well, I mean, I think they are potentially powerful. I think you've got to put that qualifier on it. And it does mean that they are at least open to having one or both parties reach out to them. We know that Latino voters lean Democratic, and so probably the Democratic Party has a much better chance at mobilizing them. But the party has done a very poor job of proving to people who are interested in immigration that it's committed to getting things done.
It's also very important in the primary because you have to be in a member of the party or unaffiliated to vote in the Democratic primary. And since the sheriff's race is all on the Democratic side, they're yes. likely to be very important.
And I was about to say, it's worth noting that not only that race, but district attorney, those two races could be decided May 8th because there are no Republican challengers in either one of those races. And they're also quite literally the top judicial positions in our county. From on the ground in the community, we'll flip the question. Do you think candidates have done a good job really trying to get to know the community and try to get their vote?
For what I've seen, there's a level of being uncomfortable with some candidates in doing that, in coming to the community. Some candidates seem to be more comfortable and have participated in multiple forums. Also, I think as a community, we need to find ways to have all the candidates more engaged and involved. I don't think the political discourse, not only locally but nationally, has been safe for many candidates to feel that they can participate in all in all the different venues. So it's getting back to a more civic engagement in participation of politics, because we can even find people nowadays interested in running for office because it's gotten so nasty. But locally, what you were just saying, what the professor was saying from UNC Charlotte, we don't have any representation. We're 15% of our county, and we don't have any representation at any level. With school board, we don't have representation, and that's something that needs to change, because even though we don't need to directly be represented for our voice to be heard, we want candidates, all candidates, to represent us. It is important for us to be represented as an ethnic group, as a community.
I have a different opinion of what Jose has perhaps because I'm more involved politically than he can. And my experience, past and present, has been that the candidates of the Democratic Party are always responsive. If you call for a meeting, if you call for a forum, they're there. For example, in the three forums that we had, all of the primary candidates of both parties and the libertarian candidate were invited. by email and by phone, some of them. No one showed up from the Republican Party. And that is really a loss. It is a loss to them to because they're missing the opportunity to get to know us and perhaps get voters for them. And it is a loss to us because we don't hear their point of view. At this point in time in the United States, there is no civil discourse politically, but nothing would be better than having a robust conversation of candidates of both parties and be able to make an informed decision.
And Jose, I want to go back to something you touched on, which is you want Hispanic voters obviously want to see themselves, hear themselves in office. When will we start to see more Hispanics run for office? I mean, you saw that last year with millennials stepping up for city council, and now we have six members under the age of 40. When do you think we'll see some Hispanics say, hey, you know what, this is my time to join the fight and run for office?
What I have seen is that the policies and issues that are now kind of lighting a flame in the interest and also the numbers, you know, are starting to get young people engaged. And they're still trying to figure that out. All millennials are trying to figure that out, and all young people are trying to figure that out because they were anti-politics, right, in general, like the professor was saying. But they're realizing that when they actually participate, they can make a difference. And so, you know, then you hear all these initiatives trying to lower the voting age to 16 in some communities that has already happened because we're realizing that the younger people are engaged in understanding their power through politics, the more likely they are to stay engaged, right? So that we are going through the same process. And what we have seen in that discussion is that we are having our own dilemmas, right? We're having our own challenges, similarly to other communities of color in the African-American community, right? How do we get our youth to engage and understand that history of the sacrifice the previous folks have done in order to have that right to vote? But now it's your responsibility to exercise that right. I don't think we never really shared that it's a community that is a responsibility that they have. We're very good as a community with our children to hold them responsible for a number of things, but not politically. It was something that we kept out of the conversation. So I think that has now changed. And hopefully, to answer your question, I think the process has started, and hopefully in the next couple of elections, we'll see some of those results.
And kind of, we have about a minute left. Wrapping this up, where do we go from here? Obviously, the May primary, you guys have done forums. There have been pushes to, again, vote. Where do we go from here? How do you keep the momentum going to November? Because obviously, there's a primary here, but November is a big deal, too. What do you do to keep that going?
We have to do the same. We have to keep the community engaged. We need to make sure that candidates and the community meet at any opportunity possible, and keep on going. It's. I always say in my house there is always a political campaign going on. There is no question about it. I mean, you go from one to the other, and that's what we need to do. We cannot not let up at this point in time. Even though that sheriff's race is very important, we also need to make sure that we vote in the general election.
And with that, Alma, you will have the last word. She is with the Civic Engagement Committee of the Latin American Leadership Future Search. I got it right this time for ending. We also were joined by Greg Weeks, who is a professor at UNC Charlotte, Maggie Cummins, who is a professor at Queens University of Charlotte, and Jose Hernandez-Paris, who is the executive director for the Latin American Coalition. Thank you all for the hour.